Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
Thank you all for joining me today. It was actually going to be my day off, but there's a lot of important things to cover. I recently, just this morning, had an interview with the communications director, Matthew Schutte, of Holochain, which is potentially going to be a decentralized internet for the future, which I'll probably be posting in a couple of days. I recommend you check it out. It was very, very interesting. But a lot of big things to talk about today. You know, the follow-up to the gas attack that did absolutely happen, verified from both sides, in Syria, that the Trump administration seemingly ignoring the fact the Yemen war is you know, the illegal invasion is continuing to carry on with civilians dying left and right. And it turns out that most of Americans actually want us out of Yemen, as well as some history on Iran and their involvement with all of this in the context in regard to Saudi Arabia. And of course, the big story that everyone's talking about that I feel is important, but is taking our attention away from some other things, which is in regard to the issue right now taking place with the Ukraine and Russia in regard to Crimea and the Sea of Azov. And it's an important story, but as I see it, it's being misrepresented largely by a lot of people. So we're going to finish with that story, so make sure you stay tuned because there's a lot of stuff to touch on in regard to the Ukraine and Russia. But let's begin today with a follow-up to the show I just did yesterday, which I think is very important. And it's in regard to, seems like one of the biggest stories happening right now, but no one is really touching on it for very obvious reasons other than the independent media. This story coming from Mint Press News entitled, "With Shoe on Other Foot, Trump admin mum on Syria rebel chemical attack in Aleppo," which the title says it all. Where are they? Why is no one saying anything? Historically, this kind of thing is exactly what the Trump administration and the U.S. government would be all up in arms about, except the fact that it's been done by the people they represent. That in and of itself encapsulates the story perfectly, but there's a lot more to talk about. So on Saturday evening, as you know, especially if you watched my show yesterday, a barrage of mortars filled with chemical weapons was launched into Syrian government-controlled territory in the Aleppo province by militants linked to al-Qaeda in the nearby Idlib province. The attack, which was confirmed by both pro-government and pro-opposition sources, so those out there still calling an alleged attack are doing so knowing that they're lying to you, has in fact left over 100 civilians hospitalized after the gas released by the mortars caused difficulty breathing, eye inflammation, shivering, and fainting. And despite the fact that chemical weapons were used by al-Qaeda-linked militants in Idlib, the U.S. government and its allies have thus far been completely silent about this recent attack. Even though the incident was finally covered by mainstream media outlets such as CNN and Reuters, although as an extreme afterthought and far, far from the front page. Now, instead, the U.S. announced a UN Security Council meeting not to denounce the chemical weapons attack launched against civilians by an internationally recognized terror group, but to address the recent hostilities between Russia and the Ukraine over Crimea, which we will be touching on in a moment. Interesting how that the timing of it all cannot be dismissed. Now, this is particularly telling given that the U.S., along with the U.K. and France, bombed the Syrian government earlier this year in April after the Syrian rebel group, Jaish al-Islam, accused the Syrian government of launching a chlorine gas attack in the Damascus suburb of Douma, which we covered extensively at the time. Of course, that attack was later found to have been completely staged. When reporters, even such as Robert Fisk of The Independent, visited the site of the area of the attack and that was alleged to have taken place and found absolutely no evidence whatsoever of chemical weapons use. And there's many other examples to show that that was in fact a staged event. The question you should ask yourself is whether the U.S. was directly involved with creating that false flag. Honest question, which I think we know the answer to. Seeing as how the U.S. and has most certainly used al-Qaeda as an excuse to launch military operations without congressional approval all around the world following 9/11. Of course, the same al-Qaeda it also hypocritically works with in Yemen and many other locations, but we're not supposed to talk about that. You would think that al-Qaeda-linked militants launching a chemical attack would provoke a response from the U.S. government. Given the U.S.'s past aggressive responses to alleged chlorine gas attacks on civilians in Syria, you would think that the Trump administration would be swift to condemn at least the recent chemical weapons attack on Aleppo civilians. Yet sadly, the Trump administration has regularly, not just now, but regularly turned a blind eye to Al-Qaeda, both in Syria and Yemen, in order to further its geopolitical agenda in those countries. Of course, to those paying attention, it's also not surprising that the White Helmets have thus far remained completely silent on the attack and have made no call, as usual, for international governments to target those responsible, as they have regularly done in the past. That is because they have shown themselves, as we reported, to be embedded with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, the terrorists, and other extremist militant groups on several different occasions, and were also, as you probably know, founded and funded by Western governments in order to further the Western and Israel-backed plan for regime change in Syria. Thus, it seems that the White Helmets are concerned only about Syrian civilians being targeted with chemical weapons when the blame can be placed on the Syrian government. Now, the same way that the Trump administration ignores the massive war crimes and untold civilian deaths at the hands of Saudi Arabia because of arms deals and U.S. foreign policy agendas, the current administration is more than willing to ignore a blatant use of chemical weapons on civilians by Syrian rebels, the very same thing it so boisterously condemns when the blame is focused on U.S. enemies, because to condemn these rebels would counter U.S. agendas in the region. It's pretty simple. Which show us many things. Chief among them is the despicable way in which the U.S. uses the idea of morality and defending civilians only when it suits the agenda, showing us that it ultimately does not care about innocent civilian suffering. It only cares to use their suffering, to use it to progress the U.S. agenda, oftentimes actually creating that very suffering to be used for its own ends. Of course, while blaming that suffering on its enemies. And of course, we already have the usual suspects trying to reframe this to their liking, while ultimately ignoring and or dismissing the actual event. This coming from Ken Roth of Human Rights Watch. Alleged rebel attack with chlorine in Aleppo is no excuse for Syrian forces with Russian backing to start killing civilians in Idlib, as Syrian shelling reportedly just did for 3 children and 2 women. 3 million civilian lives at stake in Idlib. Just such a shift to, wait a minute, they're not just bomb people with chemical weapons, but look over there while we report on something we can't prove. Now, it turns out this is coming from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. You know, that man that lives in the UK and runs a t-shirt shop that we've proven? Yeah, that guy. He's the one reporting that this is happening. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it's a very, very untrustworthy source, as it were. Now, the point for this is that we've talked about this many times. Syria, just recently, 11 civilians were killed in a U.S. bombing in Syria. Where were you then, Ken Roth? Why now are you only saying this to divert attention from a chemical weapons use that you usually jump all up about? It's just very revealing to see this kind of thing, trying to divert the attention away to what Syria is doing, as opposed to the rebels that the U.S. are backing and what they just carried out about, and of course, calling it an alleged attack. That's what it all comes back to. Now, in a story that I want to touch on here that I feel is pertinent to all of this, a little bit of history and information about Iran as it plays in with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, which I think is very important to the larger story today. This coming from Global Research, entitled Iran, Saudi Arabia, and a History of U.S. Aggression. Great article, lots of good information. Now, this is important. The article makes some very important points about the true nature of the U.S.-Iran dynamic. Now, many of you probably know this information, but my hopes is reaching some people that are unaware of this. Now, it points out that during the Iran-U.S. wrangling over the past 3 decades, Tehran has repeatedly delivered on its promises, while the U.S. has fallen short. In the late 1980s, President George H.W. Bush asked Iran to help with the release of Western hostages in Lebanon, vowing goodwill for goodwill. Sound familiar? Iran facilitated the release. In return, the U.S. increased pressure on Iran. In 2001, when the U.S. asked for Iran's support in the war on terror in Afghanistan, Iran's Revolutionary Guard gave crucial intelligence to the U.S. military. Tehran also played a constructive role in Afghanistan by throwing its full support behind the U.S.-backed president, Hamid Karzai. But, of course, President George W. Bush responded by putting Iran on the axis of evil. Iran also delivered on its promise to end the 2015 nuclear deal, their promises. And of course, the International Atomic Energy Agency, as we've reported, repeatedly confirmed that Iran was upholding its end of the bargain. But not only did the U.S. withdraw from the deal, it has also since engaged in a maximum pressure policy, aiming to force Iran to capitulate to its demands. In his recent statement, Trump, as we reported as well, launched straight into an attack on Iran as the root of all evil in the world, rather than immediately addressing what was meant to be the subject of it, specifically Saudi Arabia and the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. Now, as the author notes, in each of the important episodes outlined, Iran respected the rules of the game, while the U.S. reneged on its promises. He also points out that the wars in Yemen, Syria, and Libya have all in fact been joint Saudi-U.S. campaigns, which many of you likely didn't know. Moreover, Washington and Riyadh jointly supported, mind you, Saddam's invasion of Iran, and of course, the use of chemical weapons against Iranians, which we know is a fact. The U.S. turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia and those use of chemical weapons, even though it was well aware of Saudi Arabia's open support for extremist groups. So think about this, all that in the context of today, with Iran being the scapegoat for all the illegal actions carried out by the West today, and the fact that the use of chemical weapons by those backed by the U.S., as we just talked about, usually get ignored, while even false claims of their use, such as in Douma, by the U.S. adversaries tend to draw military action, which I would argue is exactly the point. And in regard to Ken Roth, his outrage over the alleged deaths in an area completely controlled by U.S.-backed terrorists, mind you, Idlib, which this seems logical, there's probably not even civilians in the area he's talking about. There could be. But in regard to his outrage over that, alleged by a very pro-Western untrustworthy source, I'm interested why he has not spoken out with such outrage about U.S. coalition bombings regularly killing civilians in Yemen, as well as many other places. As I just said, they recently killed 11 people in Syria. He wasn't screaming about it then. But as it transitions to the next article, which is very important, as you know, we talk about regularly on the show, this coming from Mint Press as well, entitled, "With Peace Talks on the Horizon, Saudis defy truce to redouble deadly strikes on Yemen's civilians." Doubling down during our peace talks and ceasefires. I wonder what will happen at the end of this 30. I mean, remember, on a side note, just popped into my mind. Remember when we talked about this in the beginning, about how disgusting it was for them to say, 30 days, let's talk about it. 30 days, I give you. Let's see how much maximum damage they can carry out in 30 days. Well, we've been covering it. Have you noticed? Almost every day there's more civilians dying. That is all on them, as it all is anyway. The U.S. and the West are directly involved in all this. But this ridiculous notion of waiting 30 days when they could just do it right then was designed to do exactly what we're seeing, giving them the note, hey, you better hurry up and get this done because we're going to do something in 30 days. It's quite disgusting. Now, of course, a relentless payload of bombs was dropped on Mustaba in just a few hours, mind you, on Saturday night in Yemen, killing 6 civilians and injuring 3. A woman and 4 children were among the victims of the Saudi airstrikes, which targeted homes in Ram district of the Mustaba region, dozens of kilometers away from the war's closest front lines. So again, Ken Roth, how about that? More people dying than we can prove. Now, upon the departure of the United Nations envoy, Martin Griffiths, which we just talked about, was there during other attacks, mind you. But upon his departure from the Yemeni capital of Sana'a on Friday, the Saudi-led coalition took that as an open door to step up its campaign of airstrikes as warplanes bombed residential areas in Hodeidah, in Sada'a and Sana'a, carrying out over 120 airstrikes, which resulted in a very high number of civilian casualties, as it was designed to. It says, quote, "They do not respect their covenants." This coming from Mohammed Jumai, who led the village's emergency response team. He said, quote, "We are in a truce. Why should civilians pay with their lives for this dirty aggression?" That's a very good question. Griffiths, the UN envoy, was in Sana'a to meet Ansar Allah, the Houthi leader, and other high level officials to discuss the group's attendance in planned peace talks to be held in Sweden next month. The Houthis, as I pointed out numerous times, have already agreed to negotiate a United Nations role in managing the vital port city of Hodeida. They're openly willing to de-escalate. The only group who is not doing that right now, verifiably so, per the UN, is Saudi Arabia, 100% backed by the United States. Or I guess technically we could say 61% backed, as our show yesterday pointed out, but largely, almost entirely backed by the United States. 20 kilometers south of the Ram district, more than 5 civilians lost their lives, and 4 were injured when Saudi jets targeted the Abdo al-Khamisi station in the entrance of the Al-Hijjah market on Sunday. According to the local residents and the volunteer rescue team who pulled the bodies from under the rubble following these airstrikes, it was clear that the men who were killed were civilians and not fighters. This is not just the unfortunate collateral damage of war, this according to human rights defenders, but an indication that civilians themselves are actually the targets, as many of us likely already know if you're paying attention. Asad al-Sharabi, a Yemeni analyst and author who supported the Saudi-led coalition upon its inception, who originally supported what's happening, has now actually agreed that civilians are the focus of these attacks. That's a big deal. He shifted his, he was once on their side and has now openly said, quote, "Most of the airstrikes have not hit front lines," he says. "Instead, the air campaign appears focused on residential buildings and markets." That's pretty damning. Now, again, most of you likely are already aware of this if you're watching this show, but hopefully somebody can hear that and go, wow, that's pretty damning that somebody who was once on their side is now saying, I can see clearly that they are not just accidentally hitting civilians, but outright targeting them with the U.S. support, with the U.S. finger on a map. Quote, "It's clear these attacks are part of a systematic strategy in order to basically punish civilians," according to Taha Abu Dalib, head of Legal Center for Rights and Development. Overall, the ongoing Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, as they report, has resulted in the deaths of over 15,000 civilians, including 3,527 children and 2,277 women. This is according to their numbers, which I can guarantee you is much, much, much more than that. And it's just, it's overwhelming to see this kind of thing, and it gets completely ignored. You know, feel free to note on these U.S.-backed atrocities, Mr. Roth. However, I doubt that you will. And that should say all we need to know about your disingenuous concerns for civilian lives. In a completely related story coming from the anti-media, which I think to be very, very important for those who may not understand the idea not only that we have actually no say in what happens and we are no longer any kind of a democratic society, and the fact that Americans simply won out of this war, entitled "American Public Strongly Favors End to U.S.-Backed War in Yemen," according to a new poll. Now, of course, polls can be manipulated, but I can guarantee you, based on my just watching this whole thing unfold, most Americans, if are even aware of what's happening, are pretty disgusted by it. That's why you don't see the mainstream media talking about it, because they don't want you to know about it. Now, a poll commissioned by the International Rescue Committee and taken by YouGov found that 3/4 of over 1,100 respondents were opposed to U.S. military support of the war. Support which has included hundreds of billions of dollars in weapon sales, refueling support, and intelligence. That's the finger on the map, pointing out the areas to go to. Now, Americans across the political spectrum expressed pretty strong disapproval of U.S. involvement in the war, which by some estimates has left more than 3 million displaced, 14 million, and I've seen upwards of almost 18 to 20 million, on the brink of famine, and 85,000 children dead of starvation. Now just think about that. How is that not the biggest story? More than half of conservatives joined nearly 9 out of 10 liberals and progressives who took the survey in calling for an end to the American support. So this is bipartisan. Americans don't want to be in this war. 82% of those surveyed said Congress should vote on whether to end or decrease arms sales to the Saudis, a possibility which President Donald Trump dismissed last week, warning that cutting off the relationship with the Saudis would result in higher oil prices, as well as the fact that the Manage Our Wolves Act actually made it so they're not even allowed to discuss in Congress whether or not the U.S. should be in the war. That's another hurdle that we have to come over. Our own laws working against us. Now, 58% of Americans surveyed did not even know that the U.S. sold weapons and provided support to the Saudi coalition, while 64% did know that civilian targets were being struck. So there's information getting out. This is including the school bus being bombed full of children and wedding parties over the last 7 months. But little bits of it sneaking out due to the independent media. The reality is that we need to continue to do what we're doing because we're reaching people. And the sad reality is that the very people who are supposed to be covering this are ignoring this. That's complicit, allowing these people to die. And this is the reality of U.S. foreign policy, as if I've ever seen it. And hopefully we can get that across to people. Now on to the big story, the one that everybody is interested in today, about Ukraine and Russia. The first one coming from antiwar.com, entitled Ukraine Council Expects to Declare War Against Russia After Maritime Incident. Now, Russia has reportedly, as you likely have all seen already, seized three Ukrainian naval vessels off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. Crimea voted to be part of Russia, despite whatever nonsense you'll hear from the mainstream media, but Ukraine considers it part of their territory. Ukraine has accused Russian ships of ramming their tugboat in the Sea of Azov and opened fire on the gunships, injuring two. Russia claims that the Ukrainian ships were illegally in Russian waters at the time and that the sea was closed for security reasons. Now, Russia has detained all 24 sailors that were aboard the Ukrainian ships. At this point, Russia has refused to release the ships. Now, Ukraine, which has been talking up war with Russia for years, is quickly escalating this, and I think intentionally, obviously. The National Security and Defense Council, they planned, it was a midnight session, at which they were seeking a declaration of war against Russia, and of course to impose martial law across Ukraine. Yet it seems the only initiated martial law thus far. But it's clear that they wanted to declare war against Russia. That's a very big deal. Now, what this declaration of war would mean, should it happen, remains to be seen ultimately, the true depths of it, as Ukraine clearly lacks the military to fight a land war with Russia, which is where NATO comes in, which is a very big deal. Understanding that this entire government in the Ukraine is there because of a U.S.-backed coup where they put in place this neo-Nazi regime. Very easy to verify this information. And yet, this very extreme neo-Nazi regime is now basically about to be led into NATO. And they're working hand in hand with NATO and the United States. So it's very clear that the Ukraine knows this and is trying to initiate this knowing that it will have the back of NATO and the United States, if not to draw them into something that the Ukraine absolutely wants. Now, the author notes that, quote, the martial law measure will likely be a pretext to launch an attack on ethnic Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. So there's a lot going on here. A lot of misinformation as well, coming out from all over the place. Actually, mainstream and independent alike. Now, Moon of Alabama, if you're not familiar with it, I highly recommend checking out, actually clears up much of the misinformation and attempts to demonize Russia over what amounts to them protecting their infrastructure from an openly hostile group. And doing exactly what they said they would should the Ukraine attempt to send ships into this area again. Now, this article coming from Moon of Alabama, entitled Russia Blocks Ukrainian Navy from Militarizing the Sea of Azov. There's a lot of information in this article I recommend you check out for yourself. But the Ukrainian government, under the U.S.-backed oligarch Petro Poroshenko, is actually in election campaign mode right now. As he points out, that's one reason why it is launching new provocations against Russia. Yesterday, Ukrainian forces reportedly occupied a town within the neutral zone between the government-controlled part and the rebel-held Donetsk area. Now, that actually might have been the day before yesterday. Now, the Ukrainian Navy has actually chosen to send the tug and two small boats through the Kerch Strait into the Sea of Azov after this. So clearly, they're trying to provoke something. Now, when the ships entered Russian waters through the Kerch Strait without announcing their intent, a Russian Coast Guard ship did in fact ram the boat and damage the boat. Now, on a side note, Jake Morfonios from Blackstone Intelligence has done an amazing job covering the story. And I actually saw the video of that from his tweet that he put out. And it's very clear, but I was going to share the video, but it doesn't really show much. But it is, in fact, a real shot of what happened. So he has a lot of information coming about this as well. Now, with Crimea back in the hands of Russia. The Kerch Strait is solely Russian territorial water. The treaty on the legal status of the Sea of Azov and the Kerch Strait, signed in 2003 by Russia and the Ukraine, mind you, provides that military ship entry into the sea is only allowed with mutual consent. And the Ukraine knows this. And they did it anyway. And everyone's blaming Russia, as usual. Now, the Ukrainian government, of course, urged on by the United States, this is, most people probably don't know, wants to establish a new military harbor in the Sea of Azov. Two of its Navy ships, a rescue vessel and a tug, actually passed through the strait on September 23rd. After that, in October, the Russian government openly warned that if it will not allow any further militarization of the sea. And despite that, the Ukraine still tried to pass it again. Now, the Kerch Strait is now actually right this moment, or as I understand it, it might have changed since I last checked, but is blocked by a large cargo ship that the Russians anchored under the new Kerch Bridge. I actually have an image you can check out right here. So you can see them blocking this. They're blocking the entry into the Sea of Azov. Now, here's a better shot that you can check out to show you what's real, what a clearer picture of what's going on here. So we can see that this is the sea, and right here is the strait. So what we're talking about, and you can see if I zoom out further, you can see the Ukraine off this right there to the left, and then Russia up to the top. And then right here is Crimea. Oops, where am I going? There we go. Okay, this is Crimea. Now, what we're talking about here is the Ukraine trying to come through this strait, even though Russia has warned them not to after they did it last time. And they forced it through anyway, because they're trying, because the U.S., with the U.S. backing, they're trying to further militarize this area. Which is, it's very easy to see what we're talking about here. And because they did it again, and because there's been threats made, Russia acted to defend its infrastructure, which actually there's more information behind that as well. Now, as we pointed out, being Russian territorial water, that entire area you're looking at, ships can pass through the strait, but are required to take on a pilot and to undergo inspections if the Russian Coast Guard demands it. The Ukrainian side understands that these are legal measures. As we said, they signed this, which has even been admitted, by the way, by U.S. outlets, that what they are doing is technically legal. The three Ukrainian ships that tried to pass into Russian waters did so without informing Russian authorities and without taking on pilots. And since Russia built the $3.7 billion Kerch Bridge that you saw in the previous picture, which actually connects Crimea with Russia, U.S. Commentators and Ukrainian politicians have threatened to blow it up. And there's numerous examples of that. So the Russians are understandably careful with any traffic near to it. And when the Ukraine began to try to bring ships in again after being warned, after threatening to blow up the bridge, Russia responded accordingly. It's pretty simple. Now, the article interestingly points out that President Poroshenko declaring martial law is actually a very convenient move for him, as it will allow him to move the March 2019 general election date. Poroshenko actually trails in the polls with some 8% of the total vote. So it seems pretty convenient for him to be able to shift the date in hopes that he can help him politically. Now, he also, the martial law, as well as many other things, will also give him complete control over the media and many other aspects of control. Seems that this is very beneficial to him. Now, the usual anti-Russian political circles are unsurprisingly using this incident to demand more measures against Russia. And of course, leading the effort is none other than the Atlantic Council. Now, as I see it, this whole story is being made into something it's not, in order to both demonize Russia and give Poroshenko an excuse to initiate martial law in order to help him politically and increase hostilities with Russia, which Ukraine has long wanted, as long as the U.S. and NATO continue to back them. Interesting how very different a story can look with only half the information. And that's what the U.S. mainstream media is here to do, to mislead you, to misinform. That's actually their real job. So when we realize that it's as simple as talking about the fact that a hostile group that has threatened to cause damage to the very location that we're talking about, who previously tried to go through and Russia warned them not to ever do it again, tried to do it again. And they were threatened, knowing they threatened to blow this area up, Russia responded accordingly. Now, could you criticize their actions after the fact? Could you nitpick every little thing? And you know, maybe they did something wrong, but the reality of the situation is this is not some open act of war by Russia. This is not some justification to carry out more aggression against Russia. It's them defending their infrastructure. You could see this in perfect reverse if this was a U.S.-controlled area, and even just make it Russia. If Russia had threatened to blow up that bridge and they came in without following the rules that they knew apply, that they signed, what do you think the United States would do? It's just so staggering that people can have such a double-sided view when it comes to these things, that if it's Russia, then they're just the bad guy and it all's okay. It's amazing to me. Now, there's a lot more layers to this story, but to me, this is the basic, the most important aspect, that it's being made into something that's completely not, and it's clear that it is benefiting both the U.S. agenda to demonize Russia and Poroshenko's political ambitions. It seems very clear to me. Now, could I be wrong? Absolutely. Could there be more to this? Absolutely. But all we have to go on is the information we have in front of us. And as I recommend you all do your research, read the articles, come to your own conclusions. I mean, these things are, it's pretty basic when you actually stand back. Most importantly, don't just blindly follow what the mainstream media tells you, because they're only blindly telling you what they're told to tell you. It's important that you think for yourself and come to your own conclusions about all this information. Well, thank you for tuning in today. There's a lot of important stuff to get out there. And sadly, the war in Yemen goes on. Chemical weapons attacks are carrying out in Syria with no one talking about it, seemingly leading towards something that's going to happen in Idlib, unfortunately. And open war seems to be trying to be made to happen with U.S.-backed extremist groups, including the neo-Nazis of the Ukraine, all while you're being misled about all of it if you watch the mainstream media. So hopefully you're not. Hopefully you're tuning into this and other independent media, watching all of them, comparing notes, and coming to your own conclusions. That's what really matters. So I'll probably be taking tomorrow off, but who knows? With something more happening, maybe I'll be jumping on tomorrow, or maybe even tonight if something breaks out. Make sure and tune in, or keep eye out for the Holochain interview that I'll be putting up shortly, which was very good. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.